When did I first decide to leave UNIT? Now there's a question.
With no easy answer, I'm afraid. It's not the sort of decision one makes overnight, is it? There are always moments. You see, in some ways, I'd already decided to leave UNIT before I'd even joined it. Invisible Ink? Grown men playing at soldiers? I don't think so. And then when I got there, it was even worse. Little blue men with three heads. It's hardly what I imagine I'd be doing when I graduated from... But then came the doctor. The doctor. So, I suppose the more relevant question would be, when did I first decide to leave the doctor? And why? I first met Jean Bazemore at Cambridge. It was Freshers' Week and we were both at Newnham. It was either there or Girton. You went to Newnham if you didn't like cycling, and Girton if you did. I didn't. Anyway, I hated Jean Bazemore at first sight. She was one of those irritatingly loud girls with far too much hair. I expect you know the type. She insisted on showing everyone pictures of her cat, Puddles. And she was wearing a miniskirt, which in those days, the 60s, were almost as irritating as the hair. To me, I mean. But then in those days, I was irritated by just about everything. I was, how can I put it? Well, something of an academic. Obsessed with physics and the biggest prude in the southern counties. Jean Bazemore changed all that. She was a scientist too, though you'd never have known it back then, reading some of her essays. I remember one she wrote about life on Mars. She got laughed out of the lecture hall. Funny. Only last week, I read an article in The New Scientist that matched it virtually word for word. Anyway, Jean Bazemore was the one who not only introduced me to the possibility of life in outer space. I shot her down in flames, of course, which is ironic, really, all things considered. But also to the wonders of... Well, shall we say she opened my eyes to life beyond the lecture hall? All-nighters that didn't involve cramming for exams and so on. She also bought me my first miniskirt. And the largest white hat you've ever seen in your life. Wouldn't be seen dead in it now, but in those days it was actually considered trendy. But you don't want to know about my hat. The last time I saw Jean Bazemore was, well... It was one of those moments I was talking about. I'd been with UNIT for about a year. The doctor and the brigadier had had some sort of argument. Well, maybe not an argument, more of a heated debate. About the electricity bill, of all things. The doctor's latest tinkering with the TARDIS had used up so much power that the local electricity board had been threatening to cut UNIT headquarters off. Anyway, the doctor had stormed off in Bessie, his car, and I'd been left twiddling my thumbs for a day or two. So I decided to catch the train down to Cambridge and see Jean. We'd agreed to meet at the Copper Kettle at noon. It was a nice place to sit and watch the world go by on a sunny afternoon. If you sat on a table by the window, you had a marvellous view of King's College opposite. Jean and I loved to sit and bitch about all the tourists sitting on the walls on King's Parade, and this afternoon I'd managed to wangle a table that afforded me the view down to the Senate House as well. When Jean hadn't appeared by 12:30, I wasn't too worried. She had many fine qualities, and punctuality wasn't one of them. But when it got to 2:00, I thought I'd better call her.
Thank you.
No reply. I decided to catch the bus over to her house. It was a fairly pleasant afternoon, and though part of me, irritated that I'd potentially wasted my only day off in the last 3 weeks, felt like getting on the train back to London, I had the nagging feeling that something was wrong. I was right. She lived in a little village just outside Cambridge called Oakington. A nice little bungalow with a name we both hated. Oh, what was it? Something twee, like Rose Cottage. Anyway, I'd stayed in her spare room for a while when we were both taking our second degrees. I used to love waking up to the birds' song and the view across the airfield, and watching the RAF doing their circuits and bumps on a Sunday morning, with the smell of jeans, bacon frying, filling the garden. She adored her breakfasts. I must have put on at least a stone living there. I even got to enjoy a feeling of mutual respect for the cat, which surprised all three of us. Elmview Cottage. That's what it was called because, well, because of the elms. When I got there, the curtains were closed, which was odd, seeing as Jean was always telling me to open them at every opportunity. If I had my way, I'd rip the wretched things down, she used to say. I knocked at the door, having decided that I was going to pretend I just happened to be passing and not even mention our arrangement. A sure way of winding her up, I thought. There was no answer. I was about to turn away when, out of the corner of my eye, I saw her bedroom curtains twitch just once. I knocked again. No reply. I called out her name. Nothing. Which is when I remembered where she kept the spare key. Jean had always been losing her keys before I moved in, which had become something of a joke. So I nipped round the back of the bungalow, retrieved it from the rather battered garden gnome, and unlocked the back door. Nothing seemed very much out of order in the kitchen. There were 2 days' worth of washing up, which wasn't unusual, and a couple of uneaten meals, which was. I called her name again, and again no reply. Passing through the hall, I picked up some unopened post. Old habits die hard, I suppose. And remembering the twitching curtains, headed to Jean's bedroom. The first thing to hit me was the smell. I assumed that she'd gone away, left some food out, and it had gone rotten. But then, as I flung the curtains open, I remembered that, of course, I'd spoken to her the day before. And although she'd perhaps been a little vague, not even Jean could have failed to mention a trip away today. The sunshine flooded the room with light, dazzling me for a moment. And then I turned around. It wasn't so much the blood that disturbed me, to be honest. It was the state of the books. Jean had always been so anally retentive about keeping her precious books pristine. She'd fly into a rage if so much as a crease appeared on a spine, and she deplored my habit of scribbling in the margins. But now, the floor was covered in torn paper, decimated piles of it, a sickening display of white and crimson, and in the corner of the room lay what remained of Puddles. I wasn't really expecting an answer when I rang the doctor. Answering the lab phone had become one of my unofficial duties at Unit HQ, and I certainly wasn't expecting to be put through to a mobile phone in Bessie. And back in those days, all of the doctor's gadgets seemed to be like something out of tomorrow's world to us. But that's exactly what happened, and the doctor told me he was already driving to Cambridge. Apparently, he and the Brigadier had enjoyed a cheese sandwich and a rather splendid bottle of vintage port, and were the best of friends again. The Brigadier, never one to neglect his duties, had taken the opportunity to tell his scientific adviser about an intriguing mystery involving disappearing scientists, and off he'd set. It's odd, you know. When the doctor told me that Jean hadn't been the only Cambridge scientist to disappear in the last fortnight, I felt relieved. Not worried, for my friend's safety, not scared that this might be the start of another alien invasion, or that Jean might end up as one of the many unexplained deaths littering Unit's top secret documents. I felt relief. The doctor will sort it out, I thought. The doctor will save her, because that's what he does. It was only when I put the phone down that I realized I was still clutching Jean's unopened post. Wanting something to take my mind off the carnage in the bedroom, I opened it. A couple of bills, a begging letter from a local church, a dental reminder card. I cleared a space for them on the kitchen table, and then I heard the familiar chug of Bess's engine on Jean's driveway. The doctor had to stoop slightly as he stepped through the low doorway to the kitchen. As he drew himself back to his full height, the light caught his shock of white hair, and for a moment I thought he was smiling. He wasn't, of course. With a deeply furrowed brow, he lay his hand on my shoulder and asked me how I was feeling. "You've been shopping," I blurted out, surprising even myself. "I love the new jacket." "Yes, well, I fancied a bit of colour," he replied warmly, and looked beyond me into the hall. "Shall we take a look?" "I'd rather not, if you don't mind," I said, my attempt at bravado starting to fail me. "I mean, I'm not saying that I was as obsessed with Puddles as Jean was, but I did live with him for nearly 2 years." "Puddles?" The doctor raised an eyebrow quizzically. "The cat," I explained, and suddenly, feeling tearful, sat down. He nodded somberly and offered me a brief, understanding smile as he left the kitchen. Whilst the doctor examined the bedroom, it occurred to me that I hadn't even been into the lounge, and that there was a very real possibility that Jean might be in there. I pushed the door open slowly. The lounge was as dark as the bedroom had been. Flicking the light on, I was greeted by a similar sight. Torn strips of paper for the most part. Something quite bizarre in the fireplace, a mangled mess of metal and glass that wouldn't have looked out of place at the Tate. Something about it intrigued me. "Did your friend have a television set?" the doctor asked from the doorway, jolting me out of my momentary reverie. I stood up, surprised to discover that, transfixed, I'd been kneeling on the hearth. "I think so, yes," I replied, indicating a conspicuously empty table in the corner of the room. "Then there's your answer." "Answer to what, Doctor?" Really, he could be infuriating at times. He rubbed his neck thoughtfully, revealing a shimmer of purple lining to his new cloak, and then nodded towards the fireplace. "That's the television set," I gasped, realizing immediately that he was right. "It was, yes," he nodded, "but I don't think it got like that in the way you're imagining." Had it been anyone else, I would have protested that they couldn't possibly know what I was imagining, but the doctor had a way of seeing right through me. "No," he continued, "this fire hasn't been lit in weeks. I think the television was dragged across here for some reason, and then fused together with the fireplace. See how parts of it seem to have melted into the ironwork here?" I hadn't. "Why would anyone want to do this?" I asked. "I haven't a clue," the doctor replied, and, anticipating my next thought, continued, "and I don't think your friend did it. I think the same creatures that killed that poor little fellow next door did this. You saw the teeth marks, I suppose?" A shiver ran up my spine. I shook my head. "I'm sorry, my dear. You must be feeling rather upset by all this. Why don't we go and have a nice cup of tea?" Again, I shook my head. "No, Doctor," I said, "this is important. You're saying that some sort of creatures try to eat Puddles?" "No," he said, fishing what looked like a peculiar dessert spoon out of his pocket. "But apparently they did try to eat this." "What's that?" He twisted it between his fingers. The light caught it, revealing an oddly blue tint. "I think that once upon a time, this might have been your friend's bedside table lamp. Look." He indicated a series of tiny indentations on the side of the crushed metal that looked, for all the world, like teeth marks. It's odd to remember that back in those days, driving along in a souped-up Edwardian roaster, theorising about alien creatures seemed as normal to me as Yorkshire pudding. I suppose that was one of the Doctor's most endearing qualities. The ability to make the bizarre and the terrifying seem utterly normal. He dismissed my fears that Jean had also been eaten, pointing out that the cat's fate had most probably been an accident. He appeared to have been sleeping in or behind Jean's record cabinet when they merged it with part of her wardrobe. The thought that the creatures could move at such a speed was almost as worrying as the idea that they might still be in the bungalow, and that it might have been one of them I'd seen moving the curtains. But a thorough examination of Elm View revealed only more mangled metal. They'd obviously had their fill and left before I'd gone in. But where had they gone? As we left the cottage, the Doctor stopped halfway down the drive and, rubbing his chin with one hand, disturbed some gravel with the other. Then, with an exclamation of satisfaction, he pointed out a hole in the ground, about the diameter of a golf ball. "I think you'll find that's a tunnel," he smiled, "and I'll guess that it leads into the foundations of your friend's bungalow, maybe even into the fireplace."
"You mean the creatures were that small?" I asked him, shocked that something of that size could have done so much damage.
"Everything starts small," the Doctor replied, "and you know what they say about mighty oaks." Half an hour later, we joined the Brigadier in another similarly wrecked house on Grafton Street. This one was the home of a cleaner, which challenged his theory that the creatures were targeting Cambridge's scientific community. In fact, it appeared that out of the 15 reported missing people, only 3 of them were scientists. I wondered how and why UNIT had got involved in the first place.
"Because," the Brigadier lowered his voice conspiratorially, "one of the first people to disappear was involved in a top-secret governmental research project."
"You mean you were sent here by the Prime Minister?" I asked.
The Brigadier bristled, recognising the lightly mocking tone that I'd inherited from the Doctor.
"Monsieur, I'm sure you'd agree that the fact that we're here is far more important than who sent us, particularly with regards to your friend's safety."
"I couldn't agree more," I replied, and then, the thought having suddenly struck me, asked, "Jean wasn't involved in the same project, was she?"
"No," the Doctor answered from the front door, "but I expect she has the same dentist." The Brigadier turned to face him. "What on earth are you talking about, Doctor?"
The Doctor held up a dental reminder card, identical to the one I'd picked up from Jean's doormat. "Trumpington Street Surgery," I read. "You're not saying that Jean's dentist is responsible for all this?"
"Oh, I doubt it," he replied, "but this does give us a common link."
The Brigadier looked puzzled. The Doctor, seeming satisfied, motioned to me to explain.
"You mean the university," I conjectured, prompting a glowing smile. "This is the university dentist, or one of them anyway. And the person who lives here, what's his name, Andrew, he's the cleaner at the university."
The Doctor held up a grubby security pass. "At Newnham College, to be accurate."
Newnham College. Funny how 2 words can take you right back, isn't it?
Jean and I shouldn't have been out at all. We'd promised each other we'd only have 1 bottle of wine between us, and that, if at all possible, we'd leave the restaurant without finishing it. We both had seminars the next day and were both responsible adults, for heaven's sake. Responsible and, academically at least, impressively intelligent. So responsible, intelligent women didn't do this kind of thing. Responsible, intelligent women certainly didn't stay up till 3 in the morning howling with laughter. Until we were marched out of Corpus Christi and back to Newnham by a very straight-laced policeman who firmly refused to help us find our shoes.
"Liz?
Liz?" The Doctor touched my arm gently.
"Sorry," I replied. "I was just thinking. So, what now?"
The Brigadier sighed. They'd obviously been discussing just that. "Well then," I said briskly, "why don't I investigate the dentist just in case?" The Brigadier seemed glad of the opportunity to get me out of the line of fire, a response I was thoroughly used to by then. "Good idea, Liz," the doctor smiled. "I'll go with the Brigadier to the railway station and we'll rendezvous with you later." "Railway station?" I asked, horribly aware that I hadn't been listening to a word they'd said. The doctor smiled, seeming to understand. "There's been a suicide," he explained, "a rather unusual suicide, but don't you worry about that now." Minutes later, I was being handed over to the rather overkeen new boy, one Captain Yates, who, far from being fazed by the idea of a metal-eating alien invasion, seemed to be reveling in the whole affair. He delighted in identifying what remained of a striking kitchen chair in one of the masses of fused metal, and even offered to drive me to the surgery. I've never been keen on dentists, and back then even less so. I walked down Trumpington Street with a growing sense of trepidation. The surgery was in a smartish terrace. The torrent of water gushing along Hobson's Conduit, the gullies that lined the street, did little to soothe my nerves as I rang the doorbell. "This is absurd," I thought. "I'm in my mid-twenties. I am not a 7-year-old. The gentle thud of canned music wafted along the corridor as I was buzzed inside. Some banal pseudo-classical piece I didn't recognise that was oddly overpowering. Sitting at a small, neat reception desk was a small, neat woman with glasses on a chain. She welcomed me with a thin smile. For a moment, I didn't know what to say. I could hardly ask her whether her boss was responsible for the disappearance of 15 university employees. And frankly, the idea of an alien invader posing as a dental receptionist and wearing a knitted cardigan seemed absurd. Sensing my loss for words, she opened her diary and offered me a newly available appointment in 10 minutes' time. Apparently, Mr. Arnold's previously booked patient had developed a nasty case of the mumps. Oddly satisfied, I took a seat in the waiting room, suddenly aware that I was feeling tired and quite light-headed. The room had no windows. Its soft light was emanating from a series of wall panels, which seemed to be glowing in time to the monotonous rhythm of the music. Thinking I'd make an excuse and leave as soon as I'd met the accommodating Mr. Arnold, I closed my eyes for a moment, vaguely aware of a sweet and a vaguely familiar smell. My first thought on waking was that I'd forgotten to set my alarm and that I'd be late for double chemistry. I reached out for the alarm clock and was surprised when my hand hit the wall. Wondering why my mother had changed my bed around during the night, I rolled over to come face to face with the small, neat receptionist. "Hello, dear," she smiled, and I saw that ironically she had the most appalling teeth. "Mr. Arnold thought you'd better have a little lie down. Some people don't react very well to the anaesthetic. Can I call anyone to pick you up?" I told her that I was fine and that my mother would be waiting outside in the car. Or at least, I tried to tell her. As soon as I opened my mouth, I recognised the familiar cold numbness of local anaesthetic. "You stay there as long as you like, dear," the receptionist cooed. "I'll just be along the corridor." My memories of the next hour or so are quite hazy. I can remember moments. The cold rush of fresh air and daylight as I left the surgery. A sharp, damp pain in my ankle as I tripped unladylike into Hobson's Conduit. A sudden panic as I realised that I had absolutely no idea where I was. Finding a telephone box and not understanding the decimal coins in my coat pocket. Thinking I must be abroad somewhere. Fainting outside the phone box, dazzled by an approaching car's headlamps. And then the calm voice of the doctor, counting down from 10. I was sitting in a large leather armchair in what looked very much like my tutor's room at Newnham. In fact, as my senses returned to me, I realized that's exactly where I was. The doctor smiled as he popped the pocket watch back into his waistcoat, red velvet matching the new jacket. "Better?" he asked. I nodded gratefully, assuming that I was, and tried to stand. A concerned-looking Sergeant Benton passed me a steaming cup of strong army tea. I took a grateful slurp and told the doctor what I could remember about the events of what turned out to be the last 4 hours. He in turn reassured me that Captain Yates had taken it upon himself to investigate the dental surgery with a small group of men. He told me what he and the Brigadier had been up to during my absence. During the afternoon, Unit had been alerted to a suicide on the railway line, just outside Cambridge Railway Station, which seemed odd, until the doctor explained that the dead man was Andrew Cull, the cleaner whose house we'd been investigating. He jumped off a pedestrian bridge and had been hit by an express train 10 minutes later, which was shocking in itself. The doctor's examination of his remains had brought further surprising facts to light. Firstly, that the impact of the fall had had no effect whatsoever upon his body. It should have killed him outright. The express train had sliced him in half, which had killed him, but the two halves of his body had remained surprisingly intact. My curiosity engaged, I insisted that the doctor take me to the mortuary, where he revealed to me his second extraordinary discovery. Andrew Cull's body was almost entirely made of metal. "Is it alien?" I asked the doctor, who was busying himself taking samples. "Not completely," he replied significantly, "though I'd guess that this blue metal here is extraterrestrial. As for this..." Carefully, he lifted a small shard of glistening metal from the body with a pair of forceps. Something about it seemed familiar. "Mike Yates' kitchen chair," he announced.
"But that's extraordinary," I stammered. "What are you saying? That the creatures somehow absorbed the metal in the house and transferred it across into his body?"
"Well done, Liz," the doctor smiled grimly. "That's exactly what I'm saying. And if you take a look at his skull..."
He turned to indicate the poor man's face, which stared up at us with terrified, sightless eyes. "Notice the bluish tint to the skin?" I had. You could hardly miss it. A closer examination revealed his skull was almost entirely composed of blue, shiny metal.
Captain Yates' investigation of the Trumpington Street surgery proved to be disappointing. Bizarrely, he found no trace of either the receptionist or any dental equipment. But he did find my handbag. Tellingly, my purse remained, but my unit pass was missing. "They must have realised we're onto 'em," Sergeant Benton surmised, prompting a caustic glance from Captain Yates. At that point, the doctor strode into the corridor and announced that he was taking a sample of the blue metal to a laboratory at the university, and that I might be interested in having another look at the body before I joined him. I was starting to wonder what exactly had happened to me at the surgery. With a nagging sense of dread, I returned to the mortuary. At first, I couldn't see what the doctor had meant. The body was apparently in exactly the same state as before, and as far as I could tell, nothing else in the room had changed. The man's blue skull seemed quite iridescent under the flickering strip light, its reflection following the line of his neck to the collarbone.
Of course, that's what the doctor had meant. When I left, only the skull had been transformed into the strange blue metal. Now, the transformation had extended downwards and was slowly but surely making its way into the man's chest.
Andrew Cull might be dead, but the invasive blue metal was very much alive. I leapt back from the table as the shoulder suddenly twitched violently. I must have let out a scream as well, despite myself, as Sergeants Benton and Broadwick ran in, guns at the ready, to witness the next peculiar development. The shoulder had stopped twitching, but what looked like a small muscle spasm remained. Each flicker sent ripples of light pulsing outwards. Mesmerized, we watched as a lump, rather like a large boil, appeared in the metal, grew to about 3 or 4 centimetres wide, and then cracked open. Something resembling a small silver worm emerged, wriggling from side to side. Then the gap in the metal widened and another worm appeared. The surface of the shoulder shattered completely as a larger shape emerged and slithered along the man's arm. The worms had actually been tentacles, still wiggling, as the creature swiveled round to face us. Two dislike, apparently sightless eyes, lined with gelatinous blue veins, twitched vigorously, and jagged teeth, excreting a dark blue liquid, clattered. A sharp metallic tail slapped from one side to another, then propelled the creature's fish-like body forwards. Benton firmly pulled me away from the table as another creature burst out of the shoulder, and another, and another. Soon there were 11 or 12 of them, all of varying sizes, all glistening with the blue liquid sliding over each other and clucking metallically. The largest one, the first to have emerged, convulsed suddenly, its body folding in upon itself, and then, without warning, soared through the air towards Broadwick. Its tail pierced his arm just above the elbow, and then the whole thing disappeared. It had burrowed its way into Broadwick's arm. He yelled out in pain and collapsed. Quickly, Benton opened fire on the remaining creatures. To our amazement, the bullets bounced off them. We were about to make a dash for the door when, in one movement, like a flock of starlings, the creatures slithered between it and us. We were trapped! Benton fired his gun again, but the creatures fired. Benton fired his gun again, but the creatures, far from being set back, were spraying the bullets with the blue liquid and absorbing them. Benton threw aside his gun, which the largest remaining silverfish leapt on greedily, prompting a small contretemps between it and its fellow monstrosities. "The window!" Benton shouted. "I'll get Broadwick!" The sound of his voice seemed to distract the silverfish from their feast. With surprising speed, the group broke into two, half of them placing themselves between us and the window. Out of desperation, I grabbed a fire extinguisher and let loose its foamy load onto them, thinking it might distract them for long enough to aid our escape. The clattering of metal teeth immediately stopped. Both of us held our breath and stood as still as we could, expecting the mass of white foam to start moving again. But no movement came. For the moment, at least, I'd stop them.
"I thought as much," the doctor announced grimly, holding one of the creatures up to the light. "Cybermats." We'd gathered together in my tutor's book-lined room at Newnham. Sergeant Broadwick was semi-conscious on a sofa in the adjoining room, occasionally moaning uncomfortably in his sleep.
"Cybermats?" the brigadier repeated. "Surely you don't mean..."
"Yes, brigadier," the doctor interrupted. "It's the Cybermen we're up against. These nasty little brutes are their pets, so to speak. Though I've not seen this particular variety before. See the liquid they've manufactured in their mandibles here? I should think that's probably a relation of the blue metal I was examining earlier in the labs. A very invasive living metal. So now we know what it's for, at least.
Do we? Asked Captain Yates.
Oh, yes, the doctor replied. You see, Mike, the Cybermen are a very single-minded race. Their primary function is to survive. It's what's motivated them from the very start. And to survive here, they'd have to conquer the dominant race, Homo sapiens.
So, basically, it's another alien invasion, I suggested.
In a way, the doctor nodded, though not in the usual sense. The Cybermen don't just destroy sentient life, they convert it. They want to make us into Cybermen, basically. And this time they're doing it with the living metal. The Cybermats are acting as infectors and converters. Remember your friend's television set? That was... Liz, are you all right? I wasn't, frankly. For a little while I'd had the most terrible headache, which seemed to be getting worse every time I looked toward the light. Closing my eyes seemed to be the only way to lessen the pain.
Interesting, said the doctor, switching the light off and pulling the blinds. You said that you were surprised to find your friend's curtains closed. I wonder if light intolerance is one of the symptoms.
Symptoms? The Brigadier echoed. Are you saying that Miss Shaw is infected?
I'm afraid it's probably inevitable. I wonder if I might have a look at that new filling of yours, Medea.
You better close your eyes first. I'm going to use my torch and I don't want to make your headache any worse. Half a minute later, I heard Sergeant Benton whistle through his teeth and the doctor's torch snap off. They didn't need to tell me what they'd seen.
I knew it already. The filling was a vivid shade of blue. The doctor reassured me that there was little to be worried about, as the transformation process appeared not to have started yet, and, with any luck, he'd be able to reverse it in any case. Inadvertently, by using the fire extinguisher against the Cybermats at the morgue, I'd mirrored the doctor's own brief research at the labs. Using a compound consisting mainly of phosphorus tribromide, he'd come up with a way of slowing the growth rate of the blue metal to virtually zero. The doctor refused my offer to act as a test subject, preferring to inject the now unconscious and almost completely blue Sergeant Broadwick with the antidote. Horrified, we watched as the Cybermat crawled along inside Broadwick's left leg. As soon as the doctor administered the antidote, it shuddered and stopped. The Brigadier seemed satisfied.
Excellent, Doctor, he snapped. I'll have more of that stuff made up immediately. I gather you left the paperwork back at the labs.
Wait, Brigadier, the doctor urged, pointing at Broadwick's thigh. The skin, now blue and metallic, was blackening in front of us, the black giving way and turned to grey. After a few moments, the poor man's leg dissolved completely, leaving a pile of grey ash in its place. And then I fainted.
According to Sergeant Benton, I'd had something like an epileptic fit, during which, and this is the bizarre bit, I tried to eat a large volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica. The doctor ordered them all to stand back, and then, when I staggered out into the college grounds, to keep at a safe distance. I came to sitting against a wall. Sergeant Benton had a protective arm around me. The doctor was standing a couple of feet away, scribbling a series of chemical formulae on a piece of paper, which he then handed to Captain Yates and instructed him to oversee the improvements to the antidote while he took care of me. Benton, having explained the incident in my tutor's room, stood to tell the doctor that I was compos mentis again. The Brigadier, who'd been busy barking into his walkie-talkie, suddenly let out a cry of surprise as a high-pitched whine cut off his signal. And that's when I hit Benton over the head with a large chunk of wall. I remember nothing about this, nor do I recall insisting that the doctor take me back to Oakington, and I certainly don't remember wrestling Bess's steering wheel from the doctor's hands the moment we approached the airfield. I do have vague memories of trying to dig a hole in the earth at the edge of the airfield, thinking it was the only way to escape from the sunlight. But the fall remains a complete blank to me, even now. The first thing I do remember in any detail is hearing the doctor land gently on the ground behind me and the feeling of the cold, damp earth on my cheek. A few feet away, the earth gave way to peculiar metallic walls which glowed in the same way as the panels in the waiting room at the dentist's. I tried to call out to the doctor as he pressed the large buttons on his portable telephone, but no words came. He informed the brigadier that we'd stumbled across an underground passageway and that he'd found evidence of a crashed spaceship. And then, as the same whine burst out of the doctor's phone, I passed out again. "Don't try to talk yet, Liz," the doctor advised me as I opened my eyes. "Interesting. I think you might have been led here by some sort of homing device. There have been 5 more arrivals since we got here, at least since I woke up. That was quite some bash on the head you gave me." I'd guessed that he was about 10 feet to my left. I couldn't see him, but I assumed that he too was restrained by thick transparent tubes through which bubbled a glistening liquid, not unlike golden syrup. Though my view of either side was obscured by another restraint, I could see directly ahead of me something like an upright coffin, apparently one of many. Protruding from its sides were more tubes bubbling away, just like mine. I guessed that I too was in a similar coffin. Gradually becoming accustomed to the light, glad that my headache had passed, the strange figure opposite me came into focus. Its body was almost entirely composed of the blue metal, though one of its hands and a single closed eye appeared to have retained their human form. The rest of its face seemed to have been moulded into a smooth, mask-like version of a human's features. The mouth had been replaced by a narrow horizontal slit. The eye was a perfect blank circle that lent an oddly sad expression by a smaller hole at its edge, which could almost have been a tear. I started as the human eye snapped open and looked directly at me. The voice that emerged from the tiny mouth slit had a monotone metallic sound, and the words it spoke chilled me to the bone.
"Liz Shaw."
With horror, I recognized the desperate eye that was staring at me. It was Jean's. Her remaining hand groped at the air between us.
"Liz Shaw. You came. I was late. I'm always late. I forgot my keys. I'm sorry, Liz Shaw."
And then, lurching forward a little, added,
"Kill me, Liz Shaw. Kill me."
I tried in vain to turn away as a tube emerged from above Jean's head, and after circling her forehead for a couple of seconds, embedded itself into her eyebrow. Through it scuttled 2 Cybermat creatures, and with one last short, shrill scream, my friend ceased to be, and the conversion was complete. "Don't struggle, Liz," the doctor shouted from my left. "Try to stay calm." Had I been able to speak, words would have failed me in any case. The doctor might have been able to stay calm after watching one of his best friends being murdered, but I certainly couldn't. Disgust and fear overcoming me, I tugged at the tubes, which responded as if they were alive by tightening their grip on my arms. I let out a guttural sob. At that moment, I heard the rush of compressed air, followed by the regular heavy clunk of boots on metal.
"Good afternoon," the doctor said fearlessly. "I gather you're our host. Might I ask you when and why your ship crashed?"
The footsteps stopped. Another chillingly emotionless voice echoed towards me from my left.
"The question is irrelevant."
"I disagree, sir," the doctor replied. "If the damage isn't too extensive, I could help you to repair it, and you could leave this planet in peace." There was a short pause.
Your assistance is neither required nor relevant. The purpose of this vessel's mission has been superseded. The life forms on this world will be made like us, and the invasion will be unnecessary.
Aha! The doctor exclaimed. So, this was a scout ship, I take it? Sent ahead to recce the planet in advance of the main invasion force? Let me guess. You crash-landed before you could make a report, and you've only recently woken up?
Your supposition is irrelevant, human.
Wrong on both counts, the doctor argued. I'm not human, and my supposition is extremely relevant. The invasion took place despite the lack of your reconnaissance report, and though I admire the advances you've made with this living metal of yours, I'm sorry to say that the cyber invasion failed. Miserably. Once again, the Cyberman paused.
The cyber conversion of the human race will continue and will succeed. The improved cyber insects will ensure a victory of science over military force.
Although I could see neither of them, I sensed the doctor's fascination as he responded to the Cyberman's boast. A victory of science over military force, he repeated pointedly. Am I to assume that before you were converted, you were a scientist, sir? I heard the lightest movement of hydraulics, which I assumed indicated a movement towards the doctor.
This unit recognizes the value of science in the development of a necessary military might,
it replied, to which the doctor countered, and the value of sentient life? As a scientist, do you recognize that? Once again, the sound of hydraulics.
Human beings are fitting subjects for scientific experimentation. That is all. This discussion is at an end. Cyber conversion will continue.
Heavy footsteps grew closer. Wait, the doctor begged. There's so much we can learn from each other. There's so much you can teach your fellow Cybermen, don't you see? By surviving alone here, by devising an alternative manner of conversion, you've demonstrated individuality. And that could be the first step towards a more enlightened...
The alternative conversion process was necessary to this unit's survival, that is all.
The doctor sounded ruffled. He didn't like to be interrupted. Was it, though, he demanded? Surely you could have simply contacted the cyber fleet and arranged to be picked up. Isn't that the usual cyber procedure? The doctor seemed to be almost mocking it. The footsteps stopped again.
Your words have no meaning. Procedure unknown.
Procedure unknown, the doctor repeated once more, sounding fascinated. That's not like you lot. You're more individual than you seem to think you are, my friend. Unless... Wait a minute. You were the original inhabitant of the ship, I assume.
Your question is irrelevant.
With that, the footsteps resumed their march towards me, and as it walked past me and through another door, I saw the Cyberman for the first time. It was taller than I expected, and though it passed me so quickly that its body seemed little more than a silvery blue blur, I can see its face even now. Expressionless, cold and smooth. It was exactly the same as Jean's. The familiar shrill whine of the Dr. Sonic screwdriver echoed from my left, then a series of snapping sounds and the slosh of liquid onto the floor. A moment later, the reassuring face of the doctor appeared in front of me.
He looked oddly bedraggled, as if he'd been caught in the rain. A swift application of the screwdriver to my casket, and the tubes loosened their grip on me. As they did so, I felt my back suddenly dampen. Then a rush of liquid jolted me forward. Regaining my balance, I stood, dripping wet, between the doctor and Jean. The saccharine smell of the liquid made me retch. I recognized it, the same smell as the dentist's waiting room.
Interesting, the doctor mused, examining a man standing in a nearby casket. Though his body remained more or less human, the lower part of his face, as if badly bruised, had taken on the blue metallic hue. I stood transfixed by what Jean had become. Hers was one of at least 20 caskets lining what I now realized was a corridor. Had I not seen her when she spoke, I wouldn't have known it was Jean. Though the smooth metallic body still seemed to be forming, it was identical to all the others. The tubes lining the casket were moulding themselves onto her arms and legs, the same silver blue as the rest of her body. I could hear liquid splash through them. For a fleeting, comforting moment, I was reminded of Hobson's conduit. But there was no real comfort to be had here in this cold, wet alien hell. Come along, Liz, the doctor urged gently. I think it's time we got out of here, don't you? Physically and emotionally drained and unable to answer, I let myself be led along the corridor. The door slid open, revealing another identical corridor, also lined with caskets, each containing a transforming blue-silver figure. He has been busy, the doctor observed grimly. Another door opened onto a small room which looked like a pilot's cabin. Sitting motionless in a chair with his back to us was a tall silver man. I recoiled slightly. It's all right, said the doctor. He's quite dead. He must have died on impact. He tapped the metallic head, which, though it had the same chilling face as the other Cybermen, was slightly different. This one had handles, which sprouted from a series of metal rings on either side of his face, a metal parody of hair. Is this a Cyberman as well? I managed to ask, aware that on top of everything else I had the most terrible toothache. Yes, the doctor nodded. This is the real McCoy, so to speak. I've seen Cybermen like this one before. You know, suddenly everything is starting to make sense now. Is it? I asked desperately, wanting to get out of there. The doctor, who'd knelt beside the Cyberman, let out an exclamation of satisfaction. Pulling the chair around, he revealed the silver figure in all its glory. For the first time, I saw what looked like a concertina on its chest, from which emerged the same transparent tubes that I'd seen before. But the oddest thing about it was that he didn't have any legs. The door hissed open to reveal our captor.
You will step away from the controls,
it commanded. The doctor acquiesced, his hands raised in gentlemanly surrender. I aped him, noticing him look pointedly at the lower half of the Cyberman's body. It took me a moment to understand what he was pointing out. The Cyberman's legs, unlike the rest of him, were a shiny silver.
Nice legs, the doctor commented, smiling. All the better to chase us with, by any chance?
Your words are meaningless.
With a swift movement of its arms, the Cyberman grabbed the doctor's shoulder and forced him onto his knees.
You are to be destroyed.
The doctor looked up calmly into the Cyberman's blank face. Now, where's the logic in that, he asked. Surely it would make more sense to convert me, like all the others?
You evaded conversion. You are to be destroyed.
The doctor shook his head. I'm a man of science. You must have noticed that by now, he said. I could be useful to you.
You could be of no use to this unit.
But the other convertees could, the doctor challenged him. I wonder how exactly. A mass invasion from Cambridge, perhaps? The Cyberman remained motionless. Do you actually know why you're doing any of this? The doctor pondered, and without waiting for an answer, continued, I've a feeling you don't, you know. And there's another thing that's puzzling me. You refer to your little pets as cyber insects, not cyber mats.
I'm starting to wonder if you're a real Cyberman at all, my friend.
The Cybermen will survive. The Cybermen will conquer to survive. You will become like us.
Do you know what I think happened here, said the Doctor? I think that this ship crashed years ago, maybe many, many years ago, and the original pilot here was killed, and it stayed buried under the ground until you stumbled across it somehow. Am I right? The Cyberman didn't reply. And it was like an Aladdin's cave, the Doctor continued, full of scientific equipment you didn't fully understand, but which fascinated you. And you started to experiment, didn't you? You started with this fella's legs, but it didn't stop there, did it? You've already told me, you know, that this ship had a purpose. Did it somehow connect with you? Was it something to do with the living metal? Was that the purpose of this ship?
This conversation will end.
The Doctor ignored him. What was your name, he demanded, before you became this? What was your name?
This conversation will end.
Tell me your name.
Gareth Arnold. The unit's name was Gareth Arnold.
The name instantly made me feel sick. The Cyberman released its grip on the Doctor.
Gareth Arnold experimented with the metal. He was successful. He will create an army.
What for? The Doctor asked.
To conquer, to convert, to command, to survive.
Any humanity that had crept into the Cyberman's voice had disappeared.
You will become like us. You will all become like us.
The Doctor suddenly leapt to his feet and, grabbing my hand, pulled me through the open doorway. Though the next few minutes are something of a blur, I do remember the throb of liquid pounding through tubes and the ominous clunk of machinery from either side of us as we darted along the corridors. As we reached another door, the Doctor lifted his sonic screwdriver, only to have it dashed out of his hand by a shining blue arm.
You will be like us.
Another Cyberman had stepped out of its casket and was standing between us and the door.
You will be like us. You will be like us. You will be like us.
Dozens of Cybermen were stepping out of the caskets and walking towards us steadily, their footsteps pounding in time to their words. So we were surrounded.
You cannot escape.
The ghastly things separated as one of them, I assumed the one we'd been talking to in the pilot's cabin, stepped forward. Gareth, the Doctor chanced, is there anything left of you, the real you? Tell me why you're doing this. Tell me what you hope to gain. The Cyberman stopped. All of them did. After a moment of stillness, he moved his head to one side as if he was thinking. All of them repeated the movement. The effect was almost comical.
Gareth Arnold wanted to understand. Gareth Arnold was alone. Gareth Arnold wanted to create more of his kind.
Listen to me, Gareth, the Doctor said calmly. I can help you. Stop the conversions now, and I can help you become human again. You don't have to be lonely anymore.
This unit has no desire to become human. Desire is unnecessary. It is an emotion. Emotions are unnecessary and illogical.
No, Gareth, the Doctor replied quietly, you're wrong. You think you've become like them, like the Cybermen, but you haven't. Not really. You're still driven by the one emotion that drove them to become what they are in the first place. The one that drives all of us, really. The will to survive. It's one of the strongest emotions we have.
You are mistaken. The survival of this unit is irrelevant. The Cybermen will survive because of the work this unit has performed. The Cybermen will grow stronger and will function more efficiently. The new metal construct will enhance and improve the cyber race. The Cybermen will survive even when this unit ceases to function.
Suddenly, I felt my jaw shudder dramatically. At first, I thought one of the Cybermen had grabbed my cheek or something, but then, to my horror, I realized that my tongue was being forced to one side by something inside my mouth.
Then everything seemed to happen at once. There was the most unearthly wail, whether it was me, the Cybermen, or even the Doctor, I don't know, followed by the acrid smell of burning and bubbling blue liquid. My face felt like it was on fire. I never felt pain like it. Then I passed out.
I woke up on Jean's sofa. Curtains were drawn, but stirring a little in the breeze. Somewhere a pot of coffee was brewing.
"Hello, Liz,"
the Doctor smiled, brandishing a hypodermic from which I recoiled.
"Sorry, my dear, have to give you one more injection and I think you should be fine."
I closed my eyes and when I opened them again, the hypodermic was empty. The Doctor was gently massaging my cheek.
"There we are," he reassured me, "all done."
"What happened back there in the spaceship?" I asked him. "How did we get out of there?" The Doctor shook his head sadly. "You destroyed the ship with your compound," I suggested. "Oh, no," he replied. "But I'm afraid I did have to put an end to Gareth Arnold's suffering. He was too far gone, I'm afraid. If I'd had the improved antidote, I might have been able to help him the way I just helped you. But the first attempt was all I had to hand, unfortunately."
I let this information settle for a moment. "But what about the other Cybermen?" I asked.
"What that?" the Doctor replied. "They're nothing I haven't seen before. As soon as Arnold collapsed, they simply walked back into their caskets, plugged themselves back in as if they were awaiting orders."
"And Jean?"
The Doctor shook his head. "I'm sorry, my dear," he said. I let my head sink back into the dusty cushion, numb with it all. "If we'd only had more time," the Doctor continued, "we might have been able to save a few of those poor people. Arnold created a living metal. There's a possibility that the process might even have been reversible for some of them. And maybe there are other uses for it, for the good of humankind, I mean. As I said to the Brigadier, I think a little proper scientific investigation is called for. Arnold's legacy will live on with any luck."
"He was the dentist, wasn't he?" I asked, shuddering, knowing the answer. "What exactly was it that he put in my mouth?"
The Doctor rubbed the back of his neck, obviously wondering whether to tell me or not.
"Doctor!"
He sighed and then handed me a handkerchief. Gingerly, I opened it to reveal what remained of the blue metallic filling, which had obviously shattered at some point, and a tiny cybermat. Feeling sick, I closed the handkerchief again. Then I winced as an exploration with my tongue revealed not only a gaping hole where a tooth had once been, but a very tender area of gum beneath it. Looking down at the mess of paper which remained on the floor, I asked the Doctor if he had any ideas why, according to Benton, I tried to eat a book.
"I'm not entirely sure," he replied, "though I suspect it was something to do with the cybermat, some mental connection as it started to invade your body. The cybermat was growing as well, you see. It had a thirst for information about structure, about the properties of metal, like the ones that investigated the television in the fireplace here. So I'd mirrored its behaviour somehow."
"Maybe."
I toyed with my gum again and regretted it.
The Doctor stood up. "Now then," he said, "do you fancy a nice strong cup of coffee?"
I was about to reply that I prefer a stiff brandy, when the Brigadier's voice barked out orders from just behind the curtains. The Doctor stood, flung them open, and asked him what was going on. The Brigadier seemed surprised to see him.
"Oh, there you are, Doctor," he stammered. "I thought you'd take him ashore to the hospital."
There was no need, thanks to Captain Yates' persuasive powers at the University Science Labs, the Doctor replied, tapping a small phial of yellow liquid.
"What are you up to now, Brigadier?"
At that point, Sergeant Benton strode up to his commanding officer, holding what looked like the kind of gun used for sedating elephants. The Doctor reached out of the window and niftily grabbed it.
"Just clearing things up, Doctor," the Brigadier stated. "Orders from Geneva."
Benton blushed as the Doctor slid open the gun carriage to reveal a barrel full of whitish fluid, the Doctor's original compound. Grimly he threw the gun aside. The Brigadier leaned forward.
Like you said, Doctor, they're not human beings anymore, he reminded him. They're Cybermen, and as such, they're a danger to all of us. The Doctor whitened. The sound of soldiers marching and shouting faded as they disappeared underground, and for a moment all was calm and silent before the shooting began. I stood up and closed the window. You did your best, Doctor, I said. Like you said, if we'd had more time.
When will they learn?
The Doctor murmured, gazing at the Brigadier, who was standing at the side of the airfield with a walkie-talkie. Shooting, killing, war.
It's never the answer.
He'd probably call it self-defense, I offered. But the Doctor hadn't heard me. He'd walked out of the lounge, distracted by thoughts I could only hazard a guess at, leaving me alone.